Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys. All right, hey everybody, welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, YouTube channel, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're getting this from. We have two special guests. One is the second most handsome doctor in the United States, Austin Baraki, and Sam Calhoun, national champion. We're fortunate to have you. How's it going, Sam?
Going pretty well. How are you guys doing today?
Well, better now. Sam, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you're from, when you got into lifting, like previous history of athletics, stuff like that. Just take us through your background.
So I'm from Louisiana, born and raised. Spent all my life there. I originally went to Nicholls State, which is a small D1 in Thibodaux, Louisiana. I did well over 3 years there. And my second semester of my senior year, I transferred to University of Nevada, Reno, where I finished out two more years. So I received a full scholarship to Nevada, and I ran there for a year and a half.
So you're running track?
Running track.
Running game? running track.
So I was a sprinter there, 100 meter, 100, 200, indoor 60, and relays.
How did you get into that? Like, you just, were at the track one day and then you decided I'm faster than all these girls and you got into it in high school, or what's the, someone recruit you or what?
So my sister ran track. So she was really good. She got a full scholarship to University of Monroe in Louisiana. So since she ran track, I was automatically assumed to also run.
Okay. And she's a sprinter.
Yep. She's a sprinter as well. So I just ran by default. So I started running in sixth grade. And how my high school is set up, since it was a small school, I was also able to run high school track. So even though I was in middle school, I was still able to compete for the high school.
There's a lot of, I know a lot of like families like that who cluster in swimming, and really in when I played baseball and all sports, that really tends to happen. Is there any further back kind of athletic history in your family besides you and your sister?
I mean, if you ask my dad, he said he was fast, and he would tell you that he's good at football, but there was no evidence of those things.
I like this. Already getting into the evidence, yes.
Very good.
My mom, she always said, like, if she had the opportunity to do those things, she would have been good as well.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
did you play any?
I kind of asked that just to set it up as, like, you're working with some pretty good genetic stock, probably, from an athlete.
Oh, yeah. My sister was great. I think she was better than I was. I just cared more and had a
Your
little
sister?
Better, yeah, and I had a little better work ethic, but she was definitely more talented than me.
So you think at the peak of your guys' running careers,
she
you think
smoke
that she,
me.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. Like I remember watching her as a kid and like she would like leave like gaps between her and her competitors.
How old is
she? She's 8 years older.
Okay. she trying to lift or what?
Right. Is she trying to lift? Yeah. Yeah, we could do some damage. Baraki, is your family like that? Like, do your parents swim or
no?
Like, what's up with that?
No, there's, I think my mom's dad, my grandfather on my maternal side, he like recreationally swam quite a bit. But outside of that, there's not really much athleticism in my family background.
You just, what, you had like a drowning accident and then you were like, oh, I'm going to be a swimmer. Like, is that what happened or no?
No, I had a good, my best friend in like third or fourth grade, I think he was like, yeah, I swim on this local, you know, winter recreation league team. You want to try it out? And at the time I was like a pretty shitty baseball player. And I was like, well, I'll go try the swimming thing. And that kind of ended up going from there. But yeah, that was about it for me.
Interesting. Yeah, we have no genetic like predisposition to being athletic in my family. Like, my dad raced motocross, so I raced motocross. My brother out of nowhere somehow got an insane amount of genetic potential. He like, oh, I'm going to run the 100. I'm going to be a hurdler. And he's a 1 inch shorter than I am. And he's just crushes hurdles. And I was like, dude, I couldn't even like in my best day. I don't think I could high jump over the hurdle. Like, I just think like it wouldn't work.
Did you ever do any hurdling, Sam?
I did it once in junior high and I literally high jumped over them. It was like, yeah, jump, sprint, jump.
Well, how tall are you, Sam? How tall are you?
How tall am I? 5'4".
5'4", okay. I didn't want to like, you know, say, oh, she's 5'3", and then be like, no, it's 5'4". Okay. And have you ever tested your vertical jump, like to see how high it was? Do you remember if you ever
like
tested?
24 inches. Does that sound about right?
I mean, yeah. So average, I know the average male like vertical jump's like 22 inches, and then female, I think it's like 16 or 14 or something like that. So that would make sense that you're above average. Sure. Have you tested yours, Austin?
No, never have.
Yeah, okay. I tested mine drunk at Wichita Falls in cowboy boots. And I was like a full 28 and a half inches. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not,
I suspect we would have pretty unremarkable vertical jumps.
Yes. Can confirm. It was funny because Bo was like, do you know how to jump? And I was like, no. No, I don't. Okay, Sam, how old are you as well? 28, 5'4", national champ from Louisiana, which you can't tell at all. Your accent is just completely unremarkable. So you ran in college, and then how do you end up in Virginia?
So my sister's in the military. So the year I was graduating college, she was also getting deployed. So I came to Virginia to help take care of my nephew. So I was playing mama to a 7-year-old for a year while she was in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how I got here.
And when did you start lifting?
So I started seriously lifting the fall of 2014. And I was recreationally lifting, you know, right out of college. You know, dad.
So in college, were you on like a strength conditioning program? Did they give you like an Excel spreadsheet? You know,
We never really took it serious. I mean, we did it. We showed up and we did kind of the bare minimum to get by. But no one really like put their heart into it at all.
I think that's like most collegiate sports that aren't football probably treat the weight room that way. I know I did back then.
It was a second job. It was like a nuisance.
Sure. Yeah.
I remember when I was a personal trainer, like right out of undergrad, or whatever, this woman, a girl came in and she was like a freshman in college, and she got sent home, like for winter break, right? And she was sent home with a program. She's track and field, and it was like high hang snatch, you know, from blocks. And she's in a commercial gym, like a 24-hour fitness equivalent. And she was like, what should I do? And I was like, I don't know. You should probably squat. To be honest, like I think that if you don't know what to do, like if you're not equipped to handle that, then maybe we just squat instead. Do you remember what your numbers were when you were like recreationally lifting in college? Like, were you squatting? I mean, were you deadlifting? Or
in college, we did a lot of cleans, and I sucked at them. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I never got into it, because I sucked at it. And
like Olympic weightlifting,
yeah,
that side of thing. Okay,
I just sucked at it. One, I was just trying to lift more than what I could. Whoa. You know, I was trying to follow suit with everyone else, and I never got formally taught. So I was just kind of just throwing it up there. And then we didn't squat because I think they didn't want to take the time to teach us. So we just didn't
clean,
do it.
Not squat. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
So we did glute bridges instead and trap bar deadlift instead.
So you're doing this Fitspo thing for a long time.
Yeah. I see some of the girls now at Nevada, and they are squatting. So maybe they have better.
Some progress has been made.
Yeah, better coaches now. And they have lifters. I noticed, I'm like, the whole team have lifters, so that's pretty cool.
Oh, shoes. Yeah. Do you remember what you were cleaning? Like, any idea, like, numbers-wise?
Probably, like, 105 pounds. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah, kilos. Well, so, because I remember I interviewed Colleen Foch, and she was like, yeah, the first time I snatched 135 pounds. And I was like, you know, that's really good, Colleen. And she goes, you know, it's not really impressive. And I was like, please don't hurt me. okay, so you were, and you graduated what year from college?
2013.
All right. So you did a little bit of like low key strength conditioning, you know, as needed through college. And then you moved to Virginia to take care of the nephew. And then 2014, you get into lifting for real.
No, how does that happen? FISPO at that point. Well,
yeah, you were fit glute bridges, booty workouts. Yeah. Yes.
I was monkeying around in the gym for a long time, for at least a year, like handstands on the dumbbells, trying to do muscle ups. I was doing a lot of crazy things for at least a year out of college because it was fun. It was the first time in my life I had like free reign to do what I wanted. Like, it was the first time without like a program, sure, without a coach, without any.
Well, this is kind of interesting that you mentioned this, because we actually talked to Greg Knuckles last week, and we were talking about kind of the approach to introducing folks to strength training and things like that. And he was making the comment that like the people that he sees who actually stick with training over the long term very often are people who do what would objectively or otherwise be considered to be like less than ideal kind of beginner training when they first go in the gym. They develop a love for it. They develop the enjoyment piece. They typically do quite a bit of variety, and they have a bunch of people around them that they enjoy training with and lifting with, and they end up sticking with it longer. And he said that his observation was that people who do like really rigidly focused stuff starting right off the bat are, from his observations, which are not, you know, data, so to speak, but, you know, relatively a little bit more likely to burn out in the longer term. And seeing kind of how far you've made it, you could argue, in spite of doing a bunch of quote unquote silly stuff at the beginning, is just kind of an interesting observation. And it's one that Jordan and I both also share, in that we started out training in ways that were not quote unquote ideal.
It was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just that, because the idea is that when you're just starting out, if you really are enjoying the gym, right, so you like enjoy going, I think those people are less inclined to start seeking out like what is the best program I can do, like right off the bat, because you're just like, this is fun. Like, I like going in. Yeah. I'm with my friends. And I would further kind of argue that those are type of people are like, yeah, of course I'm going to add a little bit of weight to the bar or do a few more reps. Like, that's just, or challenge myself in some other way. That's just our inclination. Yeah. Right. So, you know, you, for instance, said that you thought your sister was more talented, but you're like, yeah, but my work ethic though. And it's like, well, there's some genetic ties into that. Anyway, it is an interesting topic
to both of us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Also, second to fourth digit ratios, but that's for another podcast. Okay. So you were screwing around. Do you remember if there was any point where you were like, I'm going to start squatting and deadlifting and like bench pressing, or like getting a powerlifting, or did that come much later?
So as soon as I got, I've always been attracted to squats, and I started squatting at Planet Fitness. Problem was, is I started squatting on the Smith machine. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was really strong until I posted a video on my Instagram, and one of my old teammates called me out. And she said, let me see you do that on a free rack. I don't know how she worded it, but she was like, let me see you do that on a free rack. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I could do this anywhere. Like, what are you talking about? You know, I'm like, of course, like, this is legit. So then I got a membership to Fitness 19, which was a gym that was closest to where I lived at the time. And it was the first time on my own that I squatted with a free bar with no assistance, and 135 felt like 500 pounds.
Right.
You know, so I was like, oh, this is what she was talking about.
It's different. You know? Yeah.
It's different.
And was that 2014?
That was probably spring 2014.
Yeah. Spring 2014. You're lifting 135 pounds. All right. Yeah. And then just so everybody knows like where we're going with this, in fall of 2016, you end up squatting 324 in competition at your first meet as a 63 kilo lifter.
Yeah.
So 132. just so everybody recognizes, like, you know, what you did. So, all right. It's early 2014. You go, you realize that the refining power of the barbell squat. Then what?
So, but then I still have ego. So instead of just training the squat, I do box squats, above parallel box squats, because with that, I could still like move some decent weight. I could still move like 225, you know, coming off the box. So I'm like, oh, you know, we're good. You know, we can still move some weight. And then a trainer at the gym was like, no, you need to take that away. You need to go down deeper. So like over and over again, I had to like retrain my squat. That's so I've retrained the squat like 5 times, you know.
Yeah.
Although I would imagine that you were still getting some degree of training effect out of doing that stuff.
Yeah, I mean.
You know? Sure.
Yeah. So it took me a solid 6 months, I know, to fully hit 225 at depth.
Below parallel. So again, it's still 2014. Mm-hmm. Are you deadlifting at this time too?
Yeah, I'm still deadlifting. Probably maxing out every other week.
That's how you do it, Bulgarian deadlift style.
wide conventional, wide hands.
Oh, wide. Okay.
Yeah, sumo grip.
So you're illustrating the picture of like just everything about your introduction to training being like as quote unquote suboptimal as possible.
But the crazy thing is, I thought I knew what I was doing. Like,
of course, everybody does.
You know, you couldn't tell me otherwise. Yeah, I thought I was legit.
Yeah,
I had my gloves.
Sure.
Gloves.
Yeah, I had some gloves.
Jeez. Yeah, it'd be hard to rationally go do like to exercise and yet at the same time say I have no idea what I'm doing here, like because that's just too much cognitive dissonance to actually take action. You know, you have to say I kind of know what I'm doing.
Sure.
Right. Yes. The gloves. I'm interested. We should find these gloves. I wish we had that to show.
I definitely have videos of these.
They'll be like legendary, like Michael Jackson's glove or something like that.
Yeah.
Pink with flowers.
All right. So a year ends up going by, you know, basically where you're exercising, training, some sort of blend of that. What makes you go to compete for the first time?
So it wasn't until I started grad school. I think it was maybe my second semester into grad school. So now it's like fall 2015. And I had a classmate. He always did his research on bodybuilding and powerlifting. You know, he'll bring up these different people. And I'm like, I could do that. You know, like he'll present different numbers. And I'm like, I could do that. You know, so I was like, I want to get strong. At that point, I was like, I want to get stronger. You know, I was like, all right, I'm tired of playing around in the gym. I actually want to get stronger. And I want that to be my main focus. So that was the fall of 2015. And he did my programming for about a month or so. And then I went home for Christmas and kind of just fell off.
That's kind of interesting after what we just said, where like you had developed this love for the gym and this habit of exercising. He writes you a formal program and then you just promptly stop training.
Well, there you go. Too rigid.
Well, it wasn't that. It's just that I went home and I didn't have access to a gym.
Okay.
Or I didn't want to make the effort to go to the gym.
Well, you know. Okay.
And then I think I either maxed out before that or after that because I was like, well, I'm not on program anymore. Let's see how I do.
Yeah.
But then I started to hang around the guys, Travis, David, and different guys from the gym who are also powerlifting. So I started to gravitate towards them, get a little more knowledge from them, and then we all signed up for the meet. I got my timeline mixed up.
Yeah.
Got my timeline mixed up, but August 2015 was my very first meet.
Yeah. So, and then what graduate program were you in at the time? Was it exercise science?
Mm-hmm.
At ODU.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, everybody around you is into fitness, mm-hmm. at least directly via education, and then maybe even additionally, like, oh, I like this because I have a personal interest in, and you know, these guys are all lifters. Cool.
Those folks, that was around the time we were kind of wrapping up medical school. I was training at that gym and I was coaching several of those other guys that she knew. And I still coach several of those other guys as well. So that was
How you made contact.
Yeah,
that's how you made contact.
From some mutual clients or some people that I coached that she trained with and stuff like that. So
I see. So just to let everybody know, your first meet looks like you ended up squatting 325, benching 100 or 205, 203, 204 or something like that, and deadlifting 440.
No, so that was not my first meet. So my
that's the first USAPL meet they have for you on the database.
Yeah, so my first meet isn't on the database, but I squatted 297.
Okay.
I benched 165 and I deadlifted 403.
Jesus.
And that was that a sumo pull?
It was a sumo pull.
So you had been training sumo already at that point. All right, cool.
It was so much of a first meet, I didn't even know I couldn't wear a Velcro belt.
Oh, wow.
The day before we were supposed to leave for the meet, he said, "Hey, I don't think you could wear that belt." And I'm like, "Why would you tell me that the day before the meet? Like, you knew I had to do this meet for like 3-4 months now. You're going to tell me now?" And they don't sell real belts at Dick's and Sports Authority. Like, you can't find a legit belt.
So was it a beltless? Was it a beltless pull in the meet?
I had to borrow a belt from someone.
Oh, okay.
That's funny. I still think it's funny. And you see, you're 132 at that meet.
138. It was a USAPL meet.
Oh, it was US. Okay, 130, and you pulled 403. Just I want everybody to just make sure that they know that at your very first meet, that you know, that's impressive. Okay, so. At this point, you haven't met Austin, or you have?
I have not.
Okay. So when did you guys meet? Do you remember Austin?
Well, I started coaching. I started coaching her actually well before I actually met her in person, because she knew those guys that I coached and was like, "Hey, they seem to be doing real well. So let me reach out and get some coaching." I think you had been getting some coaching from some other organization before we started, and then we started working together. But I was already out of Virginia at that time, because again, this was after we finished med school. I was down here in Texas already for residency. So I coached her for a while before I actually made a trip back to Virginia and met her and trained with her in person. So
do you remember when that was, Austin?
That was after her first nationals. That those numbers that you quoted were from her first nationals, and so it was like a month after that we got started working together, which was at this point like 2.5 years ago, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, that Nationals 2016. I see.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. So you guys have been working together now for a little over 2 years.
This is our anniversary time. I contacted you right after Nationals. After Nationals, that's when I contacted you.
Yep.
But hey, these guys are getting strong. I want to get strong too.
So at that time, so 2016, now did you qualify to go to Worlds from 2016, or was that 2017 Raw Nationals where you ended up qualifying to go to Worlds?
That was 2017 Raw Nationals that I qualified. And I was the first alternate, and that's how I qualified, how the system is set up.
Okay. So you guys have been working together for a little over a year before you went to Worlds. What was that like? What was so these Worlds, where were these ones at? These were at, those in, I forget the country.
Canada.
Oh, these were the ones in Canada. I thought that. Okay, I got that one confused.
You were thinking
with the ones
of
that
the
Leah
ones
went
in
to.
Minsk, Belarus.
Yes. Okay, so you're up in Canada. You made it to the world team. What was that experience like?
It was awesome. However, that nationals before that, the Raw Nationals before that, I had a rough meet, and we never figured out why. So in the back of my mind, I'm like, I hope this doesn't happen again, because I don't know what happened before. So, you know, so that was my biggest fear for Worlds, is like just completely, you know, shit in the bed, really. But once I got my first squad in and it moved like it was supposed to move, everything else kind of followed. And I knew it would be a good day.
Yeah, it looks like compared to that Raw Nationals, you did a PR, everything, and then you'd done the Arnold in between, and so it sounds like you almost matched all those numbers until the deadlift when you got to chip that for a new world record. What's it like to set a world record? These are things I will never experience. So I just like, take us through. I mean, did you know it was a world record pull before you went onto the platform?
Yes, because so for Worlds, and we can kind of talk about this, I had the option of either pulling for the win or pulling the world record.
So they left that up to you?
Yeah, they left it up to me. So I had nothing to lose. I had first in the deadlift regardless. I had second in the meet regardless. So I either could have pulled for the win or just settle for the world record. And that wasn't the option that was displayed. It was like, hey, do you want to pull for the win? And then it was like, well, if you don't, we do have this. I was like, all right, let's take that. And for me, it was mainly because my second attempt was so hard that I didn't think I could make that jump.
I see. Because the your second attempt was what?
474, something like that. And the push
474.
The push off the floor is deadly. So I just didn't know how that jump was going to play out.
Right. So to pull for the win, it would have been 225 kilos, right? So 495. And then you ended up pulling 489, 480. Yeah. So after you pulled 488, so you already knew it was a world record.
That was, and you were pretty that was Kim's world record.
Yeah, it was Kim's world record.
Kim Walford's old world record. Yeah. 60. When she was a 63.
Yeah. So after you pulled it, you're like, cool, I got a world record. But when you locked it out, were you like, dang, I should have gone 225.
No, I mean, in the moment, I was super happy. I was pumped. It wasn't until, like, after. Like, I was sitting at dinner, and people was like, hey, why didn't you go for the win? Like, whose decision was that? Like, and I was like, wait, what? It wasn't until those moments, and I was like, oh, snap. You know, and I started checking my Instagram, and people was like, what just happened? Why didn't she pull for the win? Yeah, so it wasn't until that I was like, oh.
That's what ended up feeding into different decision making at nationals this past fall, where she was like, I want no options presented to me. Just load the bar and I'll pull whatever it is.
I mean, do you think that you had another 7 pounds in you to pull for the win?
If I had a fourth attempt, it's easy to say yes.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean? It's just hard that jump is crazy. And I don't think people understand those jumps.
Yeah, exactly. So going from what you had thought was a much harder attempt on your second to third, you felt like maybe that was all you could have done for a third. But then after the third, if you would have gone up 7 pounds, you'd be like, maybe I got this.
Right. You know, if I'm in the gym and I could get unlimited attempts, you know, then sure. But you only get three.
Sure. Okay. So that's your first world's appearance. So you're riding this high. You've got a world record. And you coming into this year's Raw Nationals, which are just held in Spokane, Washington. And Austin, you can comment on this first if you like.
Sure.
What was your game plan? Because you know, I mean, it seems like the overall goal is, especially in the USAPL sort of structure, you want to win Raw Nationals and get a crazy high Wilkes, so that way you're chosen to go to Worlds, right? That's like the top. That's your goal. Did you have any, I don't know, special approach coaching this coming in, just to try to ensure that this was going to happen?
Well, I mean, I remember from before we did this, I pulled up her initial like coaching inquiry from when we first got started to like refresh my memory on where she was at and what she wanted to do back then. And from the very beginning, the goal has been to win nationals. But of course, we know that in the 63 kilo weight class, there is a formidable opponent by the name of Jennifer Thompson, among others.
Show me my opponent.
So, you know, that was definitely a huge order to try to not just beat her, but even catch her in the first place. And at the time, you know, there was also Kristen Dunsmore that you were kind of going back and forth with at meet after meet before she has since moved up to the 72s. So we had a lot of competition in that weight class. And from the very beginning, every meet that Sam did, you know, she had certain kind of, I suppose, weak areas in her lifts. And so, for example, like she had possibly the nastiest sticking point right above parallel in the squat that I've ever seen on anybody. And every time she'd go to squat, I would get like chest pain when she gets the squat command, because I'm like, please let her just blow through this thing. And there's been meets where she's done like a 2 second pause squat above parallel before she gets through it and finishes it. So we had a lot of work to do from that standpoint. Similarly, early on, her deadlift, she would, you know, just rip it off the floor, get it to right above the knees, and then it would be another like 4 seconds by the time she's able to get it locked out. So same kind of deal there. I'd get recurrent chest pain when the deadlifts came around. I'm like, is she going to lock this thing out or not? I remember that happening at one of the Arnold meets in particular. And so that kind of modified the programming approach to, you know, we don't talk a lot about from our coaching and programming stuff towards like the concepts of like, you know, attacking weak points and stuff like that. But at the time I was like, man, this is something that I can't just keep throwing like regular old training at this and expect it to just magically disappear. So we put some work into her squat and deadlift mechanics for, you know, to get as much efficiency out of it as possible. But the amount of leg strengthening, like quad focused work that I've thrown at her in the past 2 years has been astronomical. And I think that is probably the thing that has contributed most, not towards making that sticking point in the squat, for example, go away, because I don't think it ever will go away at her maximum type weights.
You think that, but it that's increases her sticking
point. It just has increased the threshold. Whereas when she started, like this nasty thing at like anything over 315, it would look like that. Now you don't see it until it's like, you know, at her last meet, she didn't even stick that bad at 374. Sure. So it's just elevated that threshold. And similarly, working on the pulling mechanics and actually pulling a lot more. We do both conventional and sumo pulling. She pulls three times a week, usually in some form or fashion. And I think all that kind of technical practice, she has, you know, when it's deadlift time in a meet, I mean, you see she's like full competitor mode, stone-faced, very consistent setup, like no, not even an inkling of like hesitation or fear, you know, at this point anymore. And all her deadlifts lock out super clean nowadays. So that's been a huge, you know, relief all around. And so that's always been my biggest thing, is like knowing the kind of competition she has to go up against. Like, you know, typically we like focusing a little bit less. I know you've talked about this in the CrossFit world, Jordan, where it's like, you're not necessarily a huge proponent of like trying to build up everybody's weak points as you are trying to capitalize as much as possible on like their strengths. There's room for both, but like get your strengths as strong as they possibly can, which I think we have when it comes to the deadlift, which is like,
sure,
you know, what's been shown. People will talk about Jennifer Thompson's first meet where she benched like 230 or something. Well, you know, Sam's first meet deadlift of 403 is on par with that, I would argue. So
sure.
We've definitely capitalized on the deadlift and added, you know, 100 pounds from that 403 deadlift almost since her first meet. But I think that because of how difficult some of those squats could be and wanting to not let people get too far ahead early on in the meet, which can have some psychological consequences even, trying to shore up some of those things has been a huge focus of our programming ever since then, to try to raise those thresholds for her. Just basically get her stronger, yeah. You know?
Well, right. So that's, I think, like weak points, you know, sticking points and weak points. I think it's a misstep to try to correct them, because I don't think that's actually
possible. Yeah, they're not going to go away.
Especially in a context of an experienced lifter.
Sure.
Like, so if you're a novice lifter and your style of lifting is very, very malleable, yeah, right? Yeah. Things are going to change a lot. And so, sure, maybe it goes away. But if you're an experienced lifter, it's been going on for a while. It's just, that's all it's doing is showing you like, this is the link in the chain that's going to break. And so you got to get stronger to raise that threshold.
Yeah, yeah,
so
exactly.
And, I think what you'll find is special exercises or variations that contribute more readily to your lifting style and where that weak point kind of comes in. That's where people respond much differently. You know, not everybody just got to do pause squats, pin squats.
Yep, sure.
Good. You're ready to go. You know, so that's, did you know that was going on, Sam? Like, were you like, okay, this is the special greatest hits edition of my programming. I'm about to go kill this thing. Or were you just like, I don't know, this looks like the same. I'm just going
to
do it.
No, well, before I was trying to find ways, before working in Austin, I was trying to find ways to avoid the sticking point. I was like, I know my squat is weak. I need to build my squat. That's what's holding me back from being a national champion is the squat.
It's fine.
You know? But I was trying to find all these different ways, all these different styles to prevent that from happening. But with working with Austin, I own my squat. Like, all right, this is my squat. This is you. Let's get stronger in this position. So I stopped chasing rabbits and I put in the work. Like, all right, this is like it. That. Now let's get stronger in this position.
I've never chased a rabbit. I like that idiom. Yeah.
You know, Google and YouTube, you know, the rabbit hole.
Oh, the rat. Yeah. Yes.
We know all about that. Yeah. There was a lot of work dedicated towards that stuff. And along the way, I mean, you know, that I'm going to work a lot on somebody's kind of lifting psychology and stuff like that. So, you know, in the course of any advanced kind of trainees training and performance, there's going to be lots of ups and downs. And so we've worked through a lot of that kind of stuff before as well, and she's become heavily fortified, I think, from a mental psychological standpoint compared to some of the
Think the first time I contacted you and I was like, I want to be a national champion, where you're like, oh god.
I just knew that you appeared to be a high responder to training, which I think everybody would agree with, meaning that you got strong very, very quickly, very early on, but the thing is that no matter how strong, high of a responder you are, particularly early, that'll manifest early on. But to achieve that level of performance against people who have been in the game for decades, like Jen, for example, it's probably going to take longer than that person wants it to take. And so then it becomes a matter of not so much is this person capable of becoming a national champion, it's are they capable of doing what's necessary for long enough to become a national champion. And that's kind of what has proven to be true with you, which might not be true for other people who operate with the same genetic stock, so to speak, or, you know, or responsiveness to training. Some people might not be willing to do all the things that, that you do, which we'll talk a little bit more about how crazy some of it is a little bit later when it comes to your work and stuff like that.
Yeah. Let if anyone is wondering like how dramatic this national championship actually was, but you know, and if you don't know who Jennifer Thompson is, like she's basically been the 63 kilo, like the champ. Like, oh, I'm serious though. I mean, if you go back to her first, like the first thing that they have listed for her in 2012, like she's winning the Classic Cup. She's winning the Arnold. She's winning the first iteration of Raw Nationals. Like, dude, she's crushing it. 63 kilos is her class. And she's a Masters 1 lifter. And, you know, she benched, I think her best bench is what, 140, 145 kilos or something?
Something disgusting, which is, like that.
It's crazy. Yeah. So, and yeah, for people, you know, 321 pounds. Okay. 63 kilo female in her 40s, benching, you know, more than you, bro. So, but anybody who's thinking like, oh, maybe she just had a bad meet. No, she had the meet of her life.
Yeah. PR, like, total she, PR Wilkes, all that stuff.
Yeah. The whole thing. And so just to kind of give you guys the play by play drama as I reenact this. So after the squats, Sam holds a 20 kilo advantage, right? And we going into bench press, you have to know that Jen's going to put up a big number and you're like, okay, The best I could hope for is that we tie on subtotal going into deadlifts. But you realize very quickly that's unrealistic because Jen opens, you know, 135 kilos and you're like, oh crap. Well, she ate that up. And so after bench press, now Jen is 17 and a half kilos ahead. So going into deadlifts, you're like, all right. But honestly, your first deadlift was 205 kilos. Her first deadlift was 170. So already now you're ahead. And so the only thing that I can think of is at that third pull, you end up having to chip 225, a half kilo, so you guys tie on total and you win on body weight. I mean, did you know that was the case?
Yes, I did know.
Okay. So, and you knew that 225.5 was going to have you guys tie. Did she pull before you? I guess she did.
Yes. She pulled right flight. Before yes. me. Yes. And exchanged words before her final pull. Like, all right, let's go. Like, let's do this.
Oh, I thought you were going to go somewhere else with that.
And it's more so her than me. I think she's a better, like, Jen is the queen. Like, she has awesome sportsmanship. She's like Mama Jen. Like, so, like, she could play the role very well. So, you know, like, she encourages everyone. She high-fives everyone. Like, she has way better sportsmanship than I am. So it's more so her telling me, let's go, let's come on. And me just reciprocating.
Sure. You're like, yeah, all right, do your thing, whatever.
She's had a couple meets though where she does that, like on her first deadlift, and then just takes an enormous jump to her second pull. So when I saw her first deadlift, I was like, that's not where she's at today. She's gonna go from 170 to like 210 or something crazy.
Yeah,
like
I mean, she jumped 25 kilos from 170 to 195.
Yeah.
But still at that point you're still ahead.
Yeah.
Right.
And Jennifer Milliken was in the mix in the meet as well. She was hunt on the hunt as well.
Yeah. Did you ever think about, I mean, I guess it wasn't your call or you kind of were not trying to pay attention. So 225.5 has you tie on body weight. 226 gives you the outright, which you could do because you hold the world record. So you could chip your own world record. Any thought to taking 226 versus 225.5?
Matt would never do that because right. if we miss, Joe's on us.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that's just not his style.
That was the call.
I probably would always win off of body weight if I'm lighter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting now if the USAPL ends up or the IPF ends up adopting the IWF's new ruling that, you know, you can't win on body weight anymore. You know, that's something that they're switched to. So basically if you take the lift first, right, then you've got it. You have to out total your competitor. Yeah. I don't know if the IPF is going to change, you know, follow suit, but, interestingly, along the same lines, Leah, if she would have won Masters 1, then she would have been selected to go to Worlds again. And so we were dealing with this other competitor on another platform. And the problem was not only were they on a platform that was very far away, right? There's no way to tell like what the attempts are going to be or whatever, but the woman was going after Leah, even though, I mean, they should have been on the same platform. So you and Jen, it was easy. If you're going to change your third attempt deadlift, you can do that. But I remember, I saw her the other woman's third attempt, and then I was like, oh, okay, so I can change Leah's third attempt so she'll just tire and beat her on body weight, which she would have done. But then the other woman was able to change her deadlift again before I could change Leah's deadlift again. That being said, I think if they had them on the same platform, I think that woman might have had a bigger deadlift even still. Because Leah and I ended up watching her third deadlift, and her third deadlift was like 165 kilos, and it looked like RPE zero. And I was like, she might have had 180. Like, I don't know, you know. So, but yeah, it was just frustrating. I'm glad that you guys were on the same platform. The prime time, it does have its advantages.
I do regret not being able to win off of total.
Because
I hate the write-up, like, one off of body weight. It doesn't tell the full story.
It's like an asterisk. It's like an asterisk next to your win.
everyone can see I have more in the tank, and I only pull that, you know, to solidify the win. So hopefully at Worlds, I can do it outright. That's my goal.
Yeah. Well, Jen had the best meet of her life by 8 kilos. At Worlds, she totaled 8 kilos less. You set a PR total as well. So you guys were literally going head to head. The last interesting powerlifting aside that I will say, you know, I was talking with Dunsmore the other day, and she goes, I think Sam and Austin hated me. Like, I thought that they just hated me. And I was like, well, no, Austin is just focused and probably tired. And then Sam is a stone cold killer when competition rolls around. Right. So I'm sure they both respect you as a competitor and don't have any ill will. And she's like,
Not at all.
Yeah, that's what I said. I go, they'll both deny it, but I'll ask them publicly.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see how this goes. Okay. So we kind of covered your sort of genetic maybe predispositions, given your sprinting background, your family sprinting background. What sort of factors do you think have led to your level of success right now? You know? You've won nationals, you've been to Worlds, you're going to the Worlds this coming year. What do you think's been the biggest contributors to your success?
So I think genetics laid the foundation. So like the very first deadlift I remember struggling with is like 295, right? The very first bench is like 145. The very first squat, 135. But 225, you know, is probably when I really had to start like working at it. And that's just the foundation. I think just the consistency over time, just the effort I give has been the biggest contributor. Like, there's no way around that. There's no amount of genetics that's going to get you that far.
No.
I think,
although there may be.
I would agree. And I think that part of the consistency piece are, it's a lot more complex than just consistency, because there's a lot of things that feed into allowing consistency to happen. So there's the psychological side of things, in that you're very resilient. You have the mental attitude of, like, you know, like I say, not training is not an option. You're always going to make it work no matter almost how crazy your schedule is or what's going on in your life. And that's part of consistency. And the other is physical resilience. So, you know, the amount of work that I throw at you, I think, outstrips almost anyone else that I coach. And you just eat it up and you do fine with it. And, you know, overall, you've been able to tolerate it. And we've been fortunate that whenever there are, you know, little aches or pains, like a hip issue or a knee issue or something like that, we can work around it or through it fairly readily, which has been, you know, a huge, huge benefit here, because, you know, a substantial injury or something can derail things for people for quite a while sometimes, and mask what would otherwise be, you know, really, really good performance. So I think that is also a huge piece of this. And I say that to emphasize that, you know, people, it's easy for people to point out to genetics and say, oh, like her first ever deadlift or her deadlift now, you know, pulling almost 500 pounds at 63 is like just freak land, which is in a sense true. But again, you work harder than all these people that are saying these things. Like, I can say that for sure.
And you know, the struggle we have been through, like people don't see the struggle. They don't see what I'm messaging you, like freaking out, and you're saying we're just accumulating fatigue. Don't worry about it. Like, those early days, like, you had to tell me that so many times. We're just accumulating
sounds
fatigue.
Familiar,
you're not going to be the strongest right now. You know, that first year was rough.
Sure.
Because you know, it was learning a whole new style, and it was a huge learning curve for me, and it was rough mentally and physically.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think just coming with that level of training responsiveness doesn't excuse you from needing to train a lot. And just like anybody else, training more generally gets more results for people. Yeah.
If it makes you feel any better, Austin and I have the same text messages. He's like, my squat's down today. I'm like, it's fine. Don't worry about it. It's
like, everything just trickles upstream. So
yes. Okay. So now I'm going to ask you, what do you think about the new, we're on the topic of Raw Nationals and powerlifting. What do you think about the new qualifying totals that USAPL came out with? They've raised the totals up a little bit to make it a little harder to qualify. Although, you know, curious to get your take on this.
So there's two parts to me. Like, Lifter Sam could care less. It doesn't affect me. As long as they have the prime time session, we're good.
Yeah, right.
You know, and because I love that the meet is huge because all those people from the morning sessions watch the evening. So it just makes for an awesome environment for us as lifters. On the flip side, as a coach, you know, I do have clients who affect them because they base their worth as a lifter off these qualifying standards. When in reality, like in track, I only made it to the national championship meet one time in all my years of competing, and that was a part of a relay team. Never made it as an individual athlete. But there was conference, there was regionals, there was different stepping stones to get to that point. So I didn't base my entire track career off the fact that I didn't make it to the national meet, because the national meet was a very prestigious thing. Like, it was a big deal. Like, you were the best in the world if you made it there, regardless if you got last.
Yeah. Well, Austin, you probably had a similar experience in swimming.
These sports that are well established, relatively speaking, like track and like swimming for sure. I mean, I didn't make it to nationals at all in swimming. Like, on the club side or on the collegiate side is even more. Like, NCAA swimming is the fastest in the world, like faster than the Olympics in many events. And that is just the result of, you know, where these swimmers come from and how the Olympic trials qualifications kind of happen. So nationals was like never even on my radar from a swimming standpoint. I knew that I was like a mediocre swimmer. And so that kind of adjusted my frame of reference to where I was like, oh, I'm going to be comparing myself to people who are at my level at the regional state level, at state level at most, was where kind of my niche was. And so I've had similar mindsets going through the lifting world. Is like starting out, you start out, you're a novice, you're pretty weak, you know, you're pretty weak, you start training and you're like, oh, now I'm the strongest person in my gym. Let me go do a meet. And then you're like weak as hell at this meet. And you're like, man, I need to get stronger. And now I'm the strongest person at this local meet. And then you bump up to the next level and the next level. And so now here I am. And I'm like, oh, I went and competed at nationals and got like 16th. But these guys at the top of my weight class are just like insanely strong. And so now I'm like weak all over again. And it's just the frame of reference. But I think powerlifting in general, you know, has been relatively less developed than track and field, been around for a hundred plus years, or swimming's been around for, you know, decades and decades. And so particularly on the women's side too, but really on both sides as a sport. And so they had low qualifying, like objectively low qualifying totals to attract tons of people, get everybody excited, involved, huge audiences, and competitive populations at these meets. But yeah, I think it's really a matter of time before nationals needs to be for national level lifters, and then there needs to be this emerging kind of regional level thing in between. That is at least how it's done in many other sports. Whether powerlifting should be unique for some reason, I don't really have a strong argument for that. But I mean, I think that people need to kind of understand that, particularly if they don't have experience competing in other sports like Sam and I are describing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the membership for powerlifting is, you know, a fraction of most of these other sports. Yeah. So the involvement is relatively low. That being said, if there was a feeder like infrastructure set up where there's a state championship and then a regional championship and then a national championship, then I think you can sort of stratify and allow, it's basically more points of entry and points of competition.
Yeah.
So like, Austin and I just train our faces off, like literally, all right, we're putting the business on hold. We're just going into hiding so we could just train for a year, go to nationals and not be competitive, like in prime to the prime time, the top three, five lifters. Yet if we crack the top 10, we could both like, you know, pat each other on the back, say, good job, bro. He said, bro. And then, but, you know, it's just, there's just a different level of competition. And so I think that right now, there shouldn't be any qualifying totals. I think the actual qualifying totals are bad because this is a cash cow and the USAPL needs to make money, right? They need money to set up that infrastructure. And I think by limiting that money, you're not saving time on the platform, really. You're not saving, you know, days at the venue needs to be rented. All you're doing is decreasing the attendance and decreasing the amount of money that you're pulling in. Like, and I feel like if the ultimate goal is to get to this sport that has this infrastructure built, you know, you have multiple USAPL certified training clubs, you have multiple different levels of championship. Well, that requires money and limiting this because if you're going to put a qualifying total in to make it a national championship, it's still too low. So all you're doing is just cutting off the people who want to show up to watch, hang out, and then also lift while they're there. So I can't actually understand why they're doing the qualifying total. It doesn't.
I don't think the attendance would drop, though. I think they're going to get just as many people in Chicago that it got in Spokane because people are getting stronger.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. So right now, yeah, I think that if they raised it to a point, so having any qualifying total, I do think actually drops the attendance compared to having no qualifying total. Does that make sense? But you're
saying
still
that it's just being raised kind of in proportion as people get stronger. I mean, like you mentioned, I mean, you got fifth a few years ago, like what, 3 or 4 years ago at Nationals?
Yeah.
Fifth or fourth or something like that, depending on whether or not you're counting Jesse Norris's placement. And at the time, I mean, didn't Lane get second that year and he pulled like 7-11 or something like that? And now it's like these 93s are pulling 700 for five. And it's like, well, shit, what do we do now?
You got to quit. Yeah, you just quit is what you do.
Yeah.
You just, I'm tired. I'm waiting for the sub-masters class or like, you know, financially independent class where you're like, you have like a real job. I don't know. I think that there's probably some fall off in attendance and how many people sign up to go to the meet when there's any qualifying total at all. And right now the qualifying totals are completely arbitrary. It does not eliminate a significant swath of the people to make the meet small enough where you save money on resources. So
like saving
it just
platforms
doesn't make any
and saving sessions and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes the meet only take 3 days versus 4 days and vice versa. So I just don't, it doesn't make any sense to me, but hey, what do I know about running a business? Okay. So yeah, the next question. So if it's me, I would actually not, I just wouldn't have any qualifying totals until you're ready to release like state championship, conference championship sort of thing. And then shift people accordingly, in which case you would have just prime time. And the way I envision prime time is you've got like a full broadcast setup where you're like following people around, you're hyping up these battles and whatever. And it's like a made for TV event. I mean, it's powerlifting, whatever. Like I don't know how much you could church it up, but that's what I would imagine. The last thing we'll talk about with USAPL and IPF has handed down the seat, says, hey guys, stop administering drug tests. And then all the people who were previously on your list of like known violators, like you reinstate them. And the USAPL said, nah, dog. what do you think about that? What do you think about
USAPL on this? Like, if we take IPF's route, that limits the number of drug tests that USAPL could administer.
Sure.
So then at the local level, at the regional level, you have all these people competing untested. And that kind of just defeats the purpose of the federation. Because, I mean, USAPL is not going to cater to the top 1%, which is your elite level lifters who are going to do IPF Worlds or, you know, the top half percent. They want to cater to everyone, the large majority. And so to have everyone compete in a level playing field, you have to test at the lowest level. If it's only 10% of those people, you know, that's something versus nothing. So how I understand it is if USAPL would do it based on the IPF standards, the test would be more expensive, which would limit the number of people that they're able to test.
Without drastically raising prices of participation and stuff like that.
Because we, the lifter, would get that call.
Correct. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, it's a tough decision. Drugs and sport are a very interesting topic.
Yeah, what do you think about it, Austin?
I generally don't think about it all that much. I'm sure you listen to them too, the Juggernaut guys' ideas and thoughts about this, not only this stuff, but about how IPF and USAPL are kind of run and managed in general. And overall, I think they have quite good ideas on the matter. I guess I'm just generally busy enough with other things that I don't care enough to, you know, worry about local level drug testing versus high level drug testing. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just going to show up and lift, everything else to follow suit. That's how I am.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's not a significant enough difference between drug tested and untested federations if the equipment and weigh-ins and judging were all the same, such that I don't know if I could make a strong argument for drug testing significantly altering the playing field. What I mean by that is, so for instance, your total at Raw Nationals was like 1,150 something pounds with a 2 hour weigh-in, stiff bar, squats below parallel, knee sleeves only, all these things. Now, if we look at the all-time world record for the weight class, 132, that puts you at second, third, all-time world record in drug test or nah. And just a couple of things, ones that I've checked, that seems like pretty consistent. I guess what I'm getting at is, I think that if you want to compete in powerlifting, then it shouldn't matter if it's a drug tested or not federation, as to whether or not you compete. Like, I'm going to sign up for a powerlifting because I want to powerlift. Well, should it be drug tested or not? It's like, well, why does that matter? Because we cannot guarantee that the drug tested federation are all clean. Can't do that. We're not using a biological passport. We're not using a sophisticated enough testing technology. Not enough out of season testing to even remotely say that people are not using banned substances on a very frequent basis. Okay, and yet your cost is a considerable amount of resources that go into that from the sport itself, which ultimately are limiting its growth. And does it actually dissuade or deter people from using drugs? And I don't think that it does, right? I just don't think that it does. I don't think it does enough good things to warrant doing it. And I think that it doesn't keep the playing field level either. I think actually all it does is hurt the athletes, because you're forcing them to do this stuff in secrecy, not using medical professionals, because what medical doctor is going to be like, oh yeah, you just do a little test, some Tren, throw some Anavar in there, you'd be good, right? So these people are all doing it themselves, right? And people get hurt that way. Anyway, that's for another podcast. That's for another podcast. What I'm getting at is that I don't know if it, you know, changes the playing field enough to say, yes, there should be two divisions. And I think that if we had a unified, if you really wanted to have a world championship, powerlifting event, it should be everybody. But you couldn't even, if you wanted to go to, what's that meet? The Kern Open whatever it is. The IPF is trying, it will stop you from doing that. You want to go show to people you're the baddest 132 in the country? You can't show people.
That's the unfortunate thing, the divide in that regard. Because I would love to do other meets, you know, besides the standard three meets a year. I would love to go to Cali and, you know, compete at some meets over there with other lifters. But we don't get that option, you know.
No. Stay in your bubble full with the interesting organizational hierarchy. I'll be interested to see what happens with Wilkes and this cease and desist thing. That'll be interesting. All right, moving along to something more positive. What are you doing right now for work? Are you done with your master's degree? Tell us about some personal stuff. What's going on?
So I finished my master's in 2016. I'm currently a coach at the Iron Asylum.
Personal training stuff?
Yep. Clientele consists of men, women, young, old, powerlifters, general fitness, you know, everything in between. So I pretty much coach everyone, who's trying to get better.
And you do in-person and remote coaching?
In-person and online.
Nice.
Where can people find more about your coaching services? This is your plug.
Samstrong500.com.
That's right. I remember that. I got a little clip from her at Raw Nationals, and she was like, Samstrong 500. And I was like, I got it. Deadlifts.
No, it was actually Wilkes at the time. Funny. It was Wilkes. So 500 is like the staple Wilkes,
Well, so she got the Wilkes. Now she has to hit the 500 deadlift. Yeah. I'm not optimistic about a 500 squat, though.
Yeah.
10 years?
Yeah. Yeah. Give it some time. So it sounds like you're working full time on a hustle. How do you balance that with your training? Because Austin, it makes it sound like you're like training your butt off.
So my schedule, obviously, you guys know it varies. So right now I train Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, and that's set. And that's our training days. So I start work on Tuesday at 4 a.m. and I finish at 10 a.m.
Jesus.
So at 10 a.m., depending on how I feel, either I'll go home and take a nap and come back and work out then, or I'll just suck it up and do it at that time. So I'll get my workout in, and then I'll start work back up. Between 3 and 4 o'clock, I'll start training clients again until 7:30, 8 o'clock. You know, so I kind of just fit my workout in between my gap. Leading up to nationals, I had a 4 o'clock client, a 5 o'clock client, a 6 o'clock client. So I'll kind of eat breakfast throughout those clients, and then I'll train at 7. And then I'll pick back up around 10 and train clients again. So it just kind of, I just fit it in when I can. And sometimes I try to give myself a large enough break that I can fit in my training. So I try to give myself at least 3 hours just so I don't have to you know, cram it.
Yeah. I mean, I could. It's enough Instagram time in there. Yeah, I see.
You got to scroll.
Got to be on the gram. So, you know, that's interesting because, and like just hearing that, you're like, how much are they paying you? So I'll give you $1 more to not do that stuff during national prep or world's prep. But then it's thinking like, I don't know, maybe that's your, there's.
You get comfortable with the uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, like Austin does better when he's like working longer hours in the hospital. And I just, you know, for me, I like melt under that. But if you had me work the night shift, I get stronger. I love the night shift, and Austin dies under the night shift. You know, it's just interesting how that ends up playing out. You know, because people would assume, well, if you just didn't have a job, if you were just a pro powerlifter,
right?
Which doesn't exist.
Honestly, I thought I would base my self-work based on my income, but it's more so on my productivity, like how much I'm working in that day. Like if I have a whole day of nothingness, I'm like, what are you doing with your life right now? Like, what is going on? You know, so it's how productive I am in that day. And the more productive I am, the better the output is.
Yeah. I think that's my everyday thing.
Yeah. That's probably same for, I mean, I think within about 2 or 3 hours of feeling bored, I have like a new project that I've started on or doing something like that. That's kind of how we ended up where we are. But I mean, I know it's true for me that in general, my training and performance tend to go better when I'm, you know, working in the hospital compared to when I'm not at all. So that's me.
Opposite.
Yeah.
So what I would,
okay.
Yes.
It's okay.
Things just tank. But if I get to work the night shift though, that's the only time when my performance goes up.
Well, time to go nocturnal then.
It's easier for me to wake up at 3 o'clock and work versus when I have to come back at night. I hate working at night.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah, I tend to enjoy that, although the way that society works doesn't allow me to live my best life.
There was, I think before we wrap up, there was one question that we wanted to get your thoughts on that we skipped over, and then we'll wrap up after that. What do you think are, at least in your kind of coaching practice, in your own training career, what do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that people make in their training and in competition?
Well, I know the biggest mistake is looking over at the next person. You know, like, you know, this person's doing that, or this person is stronger than me, I should be doing that, and not staying in their lane. That's the biggest mistake, you know, not focusing on them. In their training, assuming that they don't have a coach, is not owning themselves. Like I said, when I didn't have you chasing rabbits, chasing the rabbit hole, going down the rabbit hole, and not focusing in on what you're trying to do and understand why you're doing it.
Yeah.
I think many people can't define their why. So I'll have clients come to me like, Sam, I want to make it to nationals, but I also want to be well conditioned and I also want to lose weight. And I'm like, stop. Like, what do you really want? Like, tell me what do you really want? And we'll focus on that. But we can't do all three. I mean, we can, but you'll be mediocre at best. You know, so I think
that's a low bar dog squad is what's happening, which don't see it right now. This dog is just jumping.
So not having a clear why and focus on what they're trying to achieve.
You're talking about embracing the process, basically, which is, I think, something that we emphasize a lot, both in regular training, but also in a lot of the rehab stuff we do with folks, people who want to, in the same way, just make their pain go away right now or get better right now, instead of embracing the process of rehabilitation, embracing the process of getting themselves back to normal training, normal activity, or the process of getting yourself to be a national champion or whatever level of performance you're trying to achieve.
Well, I like that answer. I don't have anything to add for once in my whole life. All right, Sam, what's your, what's next for you? What's your next meet? Are you going to do the Arnold, or are you just doing a, okay. You got the Arnold coming up, then Worlds, Nationals. That's a full 2019.
Yep.
We already know where people can find out more about you. SamStrength500.com.
SamStrong500.com, right?
Ah, sorry. Yeah. Link in bio. And, cool, man. Well, thank you for joining us here on the Barbell Medicine podcast.
Yep.
Hey guys, if you want to help us out, leave us a positive review, go check out Sam's website. And I really wish you could see this video of this dog just going crazy on Sam right now.
At least he's not barking.
All right. Say bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
See ya.